Robert LaPrade reviews multi-ligament knee surgery tips and pearls. Dr. LaPrade is a complex knee and sports medicine specialist at Twin Cities Orthopedics, Eagan, Minnesota. He was recorded at the K.P. Dale Daniel Orthopedic Symposium presented by Kaiser Permanente and their meetings and events department.
My talk's mainly going to be like it's a story. But the other thing is it's a holiday today in Minnesota. It's not because it's George Washington's 288th birthday. It's because we beat the Russians 40 years ago. And in my state, that's a holiday where everybody still celebrates and makes the first page of the newspaper. What I'd like to do is go through the little journey that Lars Engebretz and myself had in dealing with multi-ligament injuries. And I'll start off by saying what others have done, and then I'll show what we've done to try to improve this. So I have a very busy practice. A lot of it is out of state, out of region type patients that come in and see me that have multiple ligaments. We do a lot of other associated surgeries such as meniscal transplants, osteotomies, trochleoplasties, and things like that concurrent with these. I also have a busy clinical practice involving research. And a lot of that is because of the people I surround myself with. I obviously can't have a super busy clinical practice and do it all with the research part. So I have a lot of people that help me, and I think that's important because I've had good people that have had good studies. So the goals of this talk today are to try to review the advancements of multi-ligaments since the 1990s, to look at our team, that's the Norwegians and my team, and to review the principles of anatomic-based reconstructions. I think that's the whole key to making sure we do better outcomes. And then looking at rehab and bracing, because they have to be tied together, and we found out that that makes a huge difference in how these patients are doing. And then report on our outcomes. First off, for definition, sports injuries in general are lower velocity, but some of these aren't. When they're skiing down a mountain 70 miles an hour, they have high velocity injuries too. A multi-ligament is at least two of the four major corners of the knee. And right now, the general feeling is early surgery is 3 weeks or less. So we've kind of arrived at that. It used to be 6 weeks, but most of us now feel in the literature it's 3 weeks or less. You still have to look at the overarching principles with these. Whereas these sports injuries, it's a low frequency of having any type of vascular injury. We still have to look for it. And also there's a low incidence of having the nerve injuries, but you can still have those. And having your partners around that can do tendon transfers and things like that are important. First off, when you look at the evaluation, the clinical exam, it's not just a standard Lachman varus valgus. You have to look for increases in that to see if there's a difference there. So when you have the significant increase in anterior tibial translation, we're thinking root tears, ramp tears, posterolateral corner injuries, and things like that, that can make a difference that you want to find out on your clinical exam. Same thing for the pivot. If you see a really explosive pivot shift, I'm thinking it's just not an ACL. It's probably a root tear or it's a ramp lesion, maybe a deficient meniscus or a posterolateral. And the new hot topic that we're finding out is the increase in slope. So if the slopes increase, you'll also have this explosive pivot that can be present. Same thing for posterior tibial translation. A PCL is only going to cause a certain amount of posterior tibial translation. It's usually about 8 millimeters, so you won't see the tibia slide back behind the femur. But if you see a lot more, we have to think there's other concurrent injuries, posterolateral corner, or maybe there's a really flat slope for the PCL that'll also increase the posterior tibial translation. And then for medial knee injuries, when medial knee injuries gap in extension for a valgus force, they hardly ever heal. And that's been published and shown to us. So those are the patients I'm thinking something bad is going on here. They're probably going to need surgery. So we're trying to make sure we isolate them out right away. And then we have to look at stress x-rays because it's important to have objective information so you know that you're actually doing surgery for the right reason. But also, so when you do your surgeries, you know if you actually did a good job. Posterolateral corner injuries, this is a workhorse, it's a varus that causes the cruciate ligaments to stretch out when we miss it. So we want to see what we have with the amount of varus gapping, but also because of the native physiologic gapping that it can occur in patients, we have to get stress x-rays. So the side-to-side difference in the literature is similar to the ACL numbers. It's 2.7 millimeters for varus stress and 4 millimeters for a complete posterolateral corner injury. And this really has helped us to be able to isolate and identify these patients right away and get them tuned in and taken care of. And we've had better outcomes because we can diagnose them quicker. So in 1995, there was an ISACOS meeting. There was a conclusion statement that we had. And we went through the literature at that point in time. And Lars and I decided from that point going on, even though I was just out in practice, just starting in months, that we weren't going to do anything open or staged anymore. We're going to do everything arthroscopic assisted and doing it one stage. And then we're going to do reconstructions instead of repairs. So what were others saying about multi-ligaments at the time? So what I'll do is go through an overview of the systematic reviews and the meta-analysis. And up until just a few years ago, and the times that I was on the podium for the Academy between 2002 and 2016, I was crucified because I was starting early range of motion. It was felt that they had to keep him immobilized for at least 2 weeks in full extension because things would stretch out, and there was often staged surgeries back then. When we looked at whether you operate or not on these injuries, before 1990, they were often casted, and the literature felt that you needed to not operate and support a non-operative treatment. But then the recent systematic reviews have shown that it's better to operate than not operate, but you can see the numbers still aren't great back then when they're looking at it in terms of overall good or excellent results. What about open versus arthroscopic? Well, we had to do all these open initially because our learning curve as a profession wasn't that great, and also our equipment to be able to do it wasn't that great. So our overall learning curve was low as a profession. But now we know with arthroscopic, we've got much better visualization. And if you know the anatomy, you can do it quickly and efficiently and do these surgeries really, really well and get the patients out of surgery in a short period of time. So there have been papers that show that arthroscopic is better than open, and I think that's important to look at. The other thing is about early versus delayed surgery. So surgery less than 3 weeks can result in a stiff knee because the healing process is still ongoing and then you're having another hit to the knee. And after 6 weeks, the problem is it's difficult to repair structures. Everything is scarred in, it's retracted, so you can't do a good repair. So we've always had that argument about what the timing is. So the 3 weeks is kind of felt to be the key thing. And we look at the systematic review on this. Early surgery is better outcomes than delayed surgery, but there's a higher rate of arthrofibrosis and higher problems with manipulation. So these patients do much better. Another systematic review showed that they had much better clinical outcomes, but you can still see they're not all that great. You know, they're doing a lot better, but they're not perfect in terms of getting back to normal ease, which is what we want. What about staged or single operation? The general feeling is that staged surgeries, when you look at the systematic reviews, don't do as well. You can start earlier rehab. There's less trauma to the knee if you just do one surgery. So there's a higher rate of failure, especially with repairs with staged. But you can consider staged surgery if there's malalignment in a chronic because you have to do an osteotomy first. Also, if you just don't have an experienced team or you just don't have the equipment there, maybe you have to look at stage. But I encourage you to look at trying to do these as single stage surgery because literature supports that. What about repairs or reconstructions? That's pretty well defined for the posterior lateral corner of the knee. There's been two good studies out there that show that repairs don't do nearly as well as reconstructions. And our systematic review is the same thing. And what I tell patients when they ask me about repairs, because Dr. Google is always something you have to talk about with your patients, as you know, I just tell them that, well, repairs are 60% successful. In the literature, reconstructions, they're 90%. And when I went to college, I wanted to get A's and not D's. And that kind of ends that conversation right there. For MCL repairs, they're a little bit better with repairs, but still MCLs do better if you do a complete reconstruction rather than a repair. So you have to be aware of that. And there's also a higher risk of arthrofibrosis with a repair. With cruciate repairs, especially with PCLs in the literature, they don't do very well. So these multi-ligaments, there's a much higher rate of return of the posterior sag. But also, this is looking at times when reconstructions weren't doing all that well either. And then what about the issues with early motion? Where we started this back in 1995, and it really didn't catch on until 20 years later. But historically, it was worried that these would stretch out if you start early motion. And the problem was if you had delayed motion, almost everybody from the podium admitted they had 30% rates of arthrofibrosis. So with these anatomic-based reconstructions on the table, we can move them full and they don't have any of the stitches pop out or anything. So we wanted to make sure we started early range of motion. And the question is there a concern with early motion? Well, when we look at the numbers out there at this systematic review, if you looked at early surgery as a higher rate of having arthrofibrosis, pretty significantly higher. But if they started early motion with the early surgery, there was no increased risk of arthrofibrosis. So that shows that you could start early motion without having the risk of having them stretch out and also having them get stiff by operating earlier. And then PCLs is still a big problem in some area of the country, and I see these patients regularly, and that in general, PCLs just didn't do as well as ACL surgeries. So there was an ISACOS meeting in 2002 where Paolo Aglietti brought together many people around the world. I was young at that point in time, but luckily was able to go there. And we summarized in 4 days all the PCL articles. And we found out that the outcomes weren't good. We needed better therapy. When you look at the two-year outcomes, the stress x-rays were 5 to 6 millimeters, which means they were halfway towards a failure or more. So we needed better objective diagnosis, and non-operative treatment was leading to osteoarthritis. The problem is that even today, many surgeons abandoned PCL surgeries because they'd see a patient with a PCL problem, they do the PCL surgery, usually single bundle reconstruction, and then it stretched out to where it probably was where they started. So they felt that PCL surgeries didn't work. And I'll try to show you some information. They do work quite well. And then when we analyze all these case series, we're making all of our decisions, evidence-based medicine from the podium at the academy and national meetings, based on these case series. So that was the problem, is that they weren't big numbers of patients. And they formed the basis for instructional courses, symposium, and everything at that point in time. So to summarize that point of the literature and the systematic reviews, what others say, they said, operate early, do single-stage surgery and arthroscopic. Reconstructions did better than repairs. Start range of motion early. And the problem is that all of this analysis together was based upon small case series. So that's what the background is. And that's where we started our little journey with that. So the way that I do all of my research is we call it the LaPrade research pyramid, where the base of the pyramid, we do anatomy, then looked at quantitative based studies and redefine the biomechanics based on that information, look at better ways to objectively diagnose something, look at anatomic reconstructions, and ultimately the top of the pyramid is looking at clinical outcomes. Because if you can't prove it with the clinical outcomes, I can't go to a meeting and talk about all this other stuff I've done without having validation of what's going on. So the principles of what Lars and I developed for this anatomic-based reconstructions for multi-ligaments, we'll do the open approach first. So if it's MCL or post-rollout corner, we'll start with that. We reconstruct all the ligaments. We don't do repairs. And then we want to have objective information. So we want to know what we start with. And then ultimately, if our program is causing these cases to stretch out or not, and then have the braces pre-fit, because the braces are part of the rehabilitation. And I think it helps because all of us have cases where the patients call in and they're supposed to be non-weight bearing. They slipped on the stairs and everything. So if they have their brace on, we don't have to worry about them injuring themselves. So this objective information, like I showed you earlier, for MCLs, 3.2 millimeters. For FCLs, it's 2.7 for varus stress. And PCL stress is 8 millimeters minimum. And we want to obtain these preoperatively and postoperatively. So we know what we start with and know where we end up. Also, for preoperative planning, it's important to be prepared. I want to make sure that I've done all this stress x-rays and get my MRIs and everything ahead of time so I know what I need. And then I'll choose my grafts. I'd like to use autografts as much as I can, even if the patient's up to 60 years old. I'll try to use autografts, but there's just times you can't if you have four ligaments to reconstruct. And I don't like where in other countries they'll go to the other knee. I don't like to do that unless it's a revision case. So we'll prepare the team the night before and the day of surgery. So the night before, I go on and talk to the team and tell them exactly what I want to do. And they roll their eyes because I do this for every case and do it the same every time. But I want to make sure that everything I could possibly need is in the room. I don't want my team running around looking for stuff. And then the morning before surgery, I'll do the same thing. We don't have cases where they're running around looking for root repair equipment or any type of rasp or something, because everything should be there. So it's a quick and efficient process there. Then we looked at the anatomic-based reconstruction principles. So our research pyramids, we started at the base of the pyramid. And we want to make sure that we know exactly where the anatomy is. And when you go back and know where the anatomy is, your surgical time can be cut down dramatically. And then based on that, we can start early range of motion. So for the MCL, we published this in JBJS a while ago. And we go in and do this first. We do the anteromedial approach first. I want to identify these structures before there's fluid extravasation, because I want to make sure I can see what's going on. And then the MCL is almost exactly 6 centimeters distal to the medial joint line. So we'll identify that point, dissect through the pes, and put our hamstring tendons down that we harvest 6 centimeters distal to the joint. And then I'll check that in every x-ray postoperatively to make sure I'm measuring correctly. So we'll harvest the tendons and put them down distally. Now, for the femur, this is where I see most of the errors in patients that are referred to me. And I'd encourage you to look at the adductor magnus tendon. It hardly ever is torn. So we call that the lighthouse of the medial part of the knee. You find that quickly and efficiently, that hemostat under there. It's also like the perfect retractor. Your PA, your medical student, your resident doesn't have to hold anything out of the way. It's doing it for you. And then we measure down 12 millimeters and 8 millimeters up, and that's where the MCL attaches. Almost exactly the same every time. So it allows you to find out where the structure attaches, and it does it quickly and efficiently. So this is a pearl that I learned. It took me a little while, even after we published our publication, to make sure I can do a quick and efficient 15-minute medial-sided reconstruction, because I can find these structures almost immediately based on these measurement points. So measured 12.6 millimeters down, distally 8.3 millimeters anterior, boom, MCL attaches there almost every single time. And then we can ream our tunnel at that location. We'll harvest the grafts. We'll tack them down 6 centimeters distal to the joint line. I use suture anchors here. It doesn't matter what type you have. And then you can tie down the MCL grafts distally, and that post reconstitutes the MCL reconstruction. And it's quick and efficient. You don't have to have a tunnel here. We've done another prospective study looking at tunnels and screws, and the anchors work well. And then you can drill your tunnel based on that anatomic landmark on the femur and make sure that you're putting that in the correct position also, and then have your tunnel ultimately have the graft go in there. So that's the step on the medial side. Now, the posterior lateral corner, when I started out, this was called the dark side of the knee. And this is the thing that we first worked on. And we have over 50 publications on this now. And I think it's not the dark side anymore, because for us to do the approach, drill the tunnels, and move to the next stage is about 11 to 15 minutes, because the anatomy is so consistent every time that it's an easy area to go and identify if you understand the anatomy. First thing is we go down and do the common peroneal nerve neurolysis. Then we identify the lateral aspect of the fibular head. So remember that FCL doesn't attach from front to back. It attaches on the side of the fibular head. So just find it at that location. You can enter the biceps bursa when there's not a big blow apart injury, and you enter that little bursa and you can see the remnant of the FCL. It's hardly ever completely torn. Then you can ream your reconstruction tunnel here. Then we'll go to the tibia. So it's important on the tibia that you find the lateral capsule, and maybe the iliotibial band is torn off. So you find those and tag them. And then we'll find that flat spot that's located distal and medial to Gerty's tubercle. And that's our anterior entry point. If you drift a little lateral, what happens is your guide pin can go too close to the proximal tib fib joint. So you want to make sure you stay in that flat spot. And then distally, you exit right at the musculotendinous junction of the popliteus. And the geometry measurements that we have from our studies, it should be basically 1 centimeter medial and 1 centimeter proximal to where your fibular head tunnel exits. And then on the femur, we found out that the attachment sites are 18.5 millimeters apart. So you can't have one graft on the femur and have it reliably reconstruct these structures on a regular basis and start early motion. So we'll find the FCL attachment site first, and then measure 18.5 millimeters and find the popliteus. You can do it in reverse too if one of the structures is really torn off. But using these numbers allows you to find these structures really quickly and efficiently. You can actually find the little saddles where these things attach if you use the measurement. So it's a lot easier to get in there and identify where the injury pattern is. And then we'll drill both pins. And I don't drill a pin and ream it. I put both pins in first and then measure between them, because you want to make sure you're definitely in the right spot. Then you can ream your reconstruction tunnels and place passing sutures. Then we'll do the intra-articular work. So I like to drill my femoral tunnels first. I'll do the ACL first and then drill the PCL tunnels. We always do a double bundle PCL. And then I'll drill my PCL tibial guide pin. So we'll get that in place. I don't ream it because I don't want too much fluid leaking all over the place. And then I'll look at meniscal repairs as needed. And most of these obviously have some type of meniscus repairs. Root tears and radial tears are common that you have to look at repairs. And then we'll ream the PCL tunnel and then the ACL tunnel. So it's important to look at the anatomy. Freddie Fu did an outstanding job at having us all get better at ACL surgeries. Maybe we don't agree with whether you have to do a double bundle or single bundle, but we do agree that we were putting it in the wrong spot. So that's the important information. And what we found out, it helps us to understand exactly where the main portion of the ACL attaches. And we do single bundles right in the center of the attachment between the anterior, medial, and posterior lateral bundles. So on the femur, you have to be as far posterior as possible. In that sagittal split, if your X-ray shows your tunnel or your screw fixation is above Blumensatz line, you're in the wrong spot. You put your graft too central. You really have to be below that line to be in the correct spot for an ACL reconstruction. And the other important thing is if you look at the tibial attachment site, most of the ACL attaches in front of the back of the lateral meniscus. So if you look at an X-ray on an MRI or something like that, and you see it behind the lateral meniscus, you know that it's too central and the ACL probably isn't working efficiently to prevent rotation. for a PCL, you have to look at these points. And PCL surgeries are easy if you understand the points. So the trochlear point and the medial arch point, those are structures you can see in every single knee. And that's exactly where the anterolateral bundle attaches. So you identify that, and then you can put your reconstruction tunnel there. And the anterolateral bundle is right up against the articular cartilage. In biomechanic literature, when they say you want to be as distal as possible, that just means for us clinicians, it has to be against the articular cartilage for this bundle. And the closer you are to the cartilage, the more likely it's going to reproduce the function and work well. And then the posterior medial bundle attaches a little bit further back, about 5.8 millimeters back from the edge of the articular cartilage. But it's important to see that so far apart between these two attachment sites, almost 13 millimeters, and one's on the roof and one's on the wall, that you really can't have one tunnel like you can for an ACL to reconstruct the function. And on the tibia, it's just too compact for both bundles, so you can't have two separate tunnels. So you have to have one tunnel on the tibia. So when we're talking double bundle for PCLs, it's two in the femur and one in the tibia, and it's not two and two. So the femoral tunnel is the landmarks here. We create closed socket tunnels. We drill from the anterolateral portal. And if you're an ACL surgeon, it should be real easy because it's right in front of you. You don't have to look in the back of the knee. And then because you don't make that extra incision, the VMO doesn't shut down. You can get these patients rehabilitated a lot quicker. And then on the tibia, you really have to be down where that little bundle ridge is. So anterolateral bundle is above the bundle ridge and the posterior medial bundle is below it. And so you want to make sure that you're right at that point, and that's where your reconstruction guide pin should come out. So when we're looking at drilling our tunnels, we want to be 6 to 7 millimeters off that champagne glass drop-off and about 1 to 2 millimeters distal to the joint line. And I like to use the mini C-arm in fluoroscopy for this because I can change my rotation, make sure I'm exactly where I want to be. The important thing is to get x-rays with PCLs because the last 16 revision PCLs I've done, every single one had an iatrogenic tear of the medial meniscal root attachment because it was too high. So you don't want to be too high because you can take out the root, and that can be a disaster. So then we'll ream this tunnel. So we put a large curette posteriorly and then pass a smoother up it to clean around the aperture. I think you can try to do it other ways, but I like to use something that cleans off the aperture posteriorly. And then I want to make sure that I'm entering posteriorly by hand. Most of us that do sports cases, we're not operating at big centers, and you probably don't have a vascular surgeon there. So when you come through, you want to make sure that you're putting the reamer through by hand in the back. And that makes it a lot less worrisome for the artery. And then we'll do the meniscus work with the multi-ligaments. You can look for these root tears that you have to repair. You can look at radial tears. Radial tears heal robustly with multi-ligament reconstructions. Greater than 80% success, even the systematic review. So if you do see a radial tear, I'd encourage you to look at doing a repair of it because they do well, especially for the lateral meniscus. Those are the ones that do terrible when the meniscus is taken out, but they heal very robustly, so you can do some repairs there. Then the ACL tibial tunnel. Now, this can be really hard to see because the knee is rotating all over the place, but if you use that anterior horn of the lateral meniscus as your point of attachment and looking at it, you can drill your guide pin in and then check from the medial portal and look back at the lateral meniscus, and you know you're not too far posterior or too far rotated. And that's probably something that I had trouble with when I was first starting out back in the late 90s and early 2000s, is that I wasn't as sure of where I was because the knee would be spinning all over the place. But once we did this study and I understood better where the ACL attaches, basically the ACL overlaps with the lateral meniscus about 40%. And we've shown that both with histology as well as with scanning electron microscopy. So it's a real thing. So you know that you have to be close to it to make sure that you're not being too far posterior, which is what we used to do. We used to measure off the PCL and then putting it in the correct position. And then we'll start passing the grafts. So we pass the grafts from the lateral portal, then pulling them down the tibia. And it's relatively easy to pull them down the tibia because you put them in the femur first, and then you can pull them down the tibia. And when I was a fellow, I worked with Glenn Terry and Peter Fowler in one of these cases, and it took us 2 hours to pass the damn grafts. And I was determined I was not ever going to have that happen to me. So we've developed this technique, and it takes about 2 seconds instead of 2 hours. And it's really easy to pass the grafts down the tibia once you get them fixed in the femur, and you can pull them distally. For tibial fixation, we've shown that you have to fix the anterolateral bundle first at 90 degrees of flexion. I like to use a screw and washer, because we found out that patients hurt a lot less than staples. Staples work equally as well. We found out and validated that with our cases, but we were able to do these as an outpatient surgery because they have a lot less pain when we use a screw and washer as opposed to the pain they get from pounding a staple in. So we fix the anterolateral bundle first at 90 degrees, and then the posterior medial bundle has to be fixed in full extension. And we found out if you don't fix them at that location, you overconstrain the joint, especially for the posterior medial bundle, because if you constrain it other than full extension, what happens is that it'll get overconstrained and stretch out with time. We found out in our robot study. And then we'll pass and fix the remaining grafts, so the ACL, and then the FCL and posterior lateral corner, and then the MCL reconstruction. Now, fixation order has always been a big question from the podium. And so we went to the robot and tried to figure this out. And it was probably the hardest study I've ever done because we had 28 pilot knees before we could actually figure out what was going on. And it changed my practice because I used to fix the PCL, then the posterior lateral corner, and then the ACL, because some of our early studies showed that if you fixed an ACL before a posterior lateral corner, it caused the knee to rotate in external rotation. But what we found out in the robot is you fix anterolateral bundle of the PCL first at 90, then the posterior medial bundle of the PCL in full extension at 0, then the ACL in full extension, then the posterior lateral corner, and then the MCL is last, with the MCL being fixed at 20 degrees knee flexion, and the posterior oblique ligament has to be fixed in full extension. So these are the fixation orders that we found in the study. And when I tried to do it the way that I used to do it, it actually overconstrained the knee too much. So it was a good thing that we could do this in a robot and actually try to make sure we're getting a knee back to an anatomic position scientifically. What about tunnel convergence? That has to be a big problem because there's so many tunnels in here. So what we found out is that when you have the FCL and popliteus, you really want to aim anterior. I aim a little bit more anterior medial than our study showed. On the medial side of the knee, you also have to aim anteriorly with both the posterior oblique ligament and the MCL to avoid the PCL. And we looked at over 2,000 different configurations for this. Now, the tibia is a totally different story. It's tunnel madness here, especially if you can imagine you're doing root repairs because you can have even more tunnels. But with the posterior lateral corner, ACL, PCL, and POL, the only ones that we found were actually a problem were the posterior oblique ligament and the PCL. We have to aim a little bit medial to Gerdes tubercle. And then the distal MCL and the PCL, where you have to aim the MCL a little bit more distal when you're going across the tibia, and then you don't have tunnel convergence. What about the rehabilitation? I can't emphasize enough that this is equally as important as the surgery. You have to make sure that your rehab team is on board. So we have all our patients be seen the next day after surgery, and we do rehab rounds on them. And we go through with our therapists and everybody exactly what needs to go on. And it's paid off dramatically because our patients' outcomes are actually, at the four-month point, my multi-ligaments are ahead of my practice average ACLs in terms of function because we're jumping on this with these multi-ligaments. So we start range of motion day one. If it's a PCL, we do prone knee flexion only for the first 6 weeks to negate the effects of gravity. We use dynamic PCL braces. There's a couple of good ones out there now for early range of motion, so it protects against gravity also. We'll use ACL braces for the ACLs and any type of collateral reconstructions. You have to look maybe at using some type of more advanced braces if you're doing a chronic case as opposed to an acute, but we're not seeing that big of a difference. And then we're planning for a minimum 9 to 12 months before we have them have a return to sport test. So our bracing algorithm is the PCL gets the priority. The PCL dynamic braces don't really push the knee anteriorly in full extension, so it doesn't affect an ACL. I was worried about that initially. We did it in the lab and found out it didn't make a difference. Then we worry about the ACL, and we're always trying to protect the collaterals. We also did some testing of some of the newer braces that are out there, and they do actually do very well in terms of putting extra stress as you increase the flexion on the knee. And I think that's why our PCLs in general are doing much better than they did historically because it protects the graft. It does increase the force on the knee to negate the effects of gravity. So what about the clinical outcome? So we've been doing all this. Basically, the systematic reviews that are out in the last 5 years have validated what we've done for the last 20, but what's our clinical outcomes? And I think it's important that you have to validate the procedure's work, but we really have to have both clinical outcomes and objective outcomes. It can't be like a knee scope and you send them a survey form at 2 and 5 years and see how they're doing, because we want to make sure that we're actually restoring stability to the knee so that they have good long-term outcomes. Because when they're not stable, our colleagues in Scandinavia that have done the long-term follow-ups on these show that they're pretty arthritic if you don't make them stable. So that arthritis symptoms may not show up at that 2 to 5 year time frame. So we have to make sure we're making them stable. So we looked at the outcomes in our acute posterolateral corners, and we're getting good outcomes, especially since 30% of them had a common peroneal nerve neuropalsy. So they're having a foot drop. With early range of motion on postoperative day one, our varus stress x-rays went from 6.2 to 0.1 on average follow-up on this group of 40 patients. So we did a lot better in terms of providing stability and not stretching out. For MCL outcomes, we also showed that we're having improvements to their outcomes and they're not stretching out. So the important thing to me is that we didn't really have any issues early on with cases of arthrofibrosis. So the stress x-rays show that it works and they're not getting stiff. What about our PCLs? So this is our first jump into this because I've been part of the Florence study. Lars and I did a lot of studies. I think we have 32 publications in the PCL now trying to improve outcomes. And this is our first outcome study. I used staples here initially with this because I hadn't recognized the screw and washer issue. And the stability was much improved in terms of how they were doing. We went from an average of 15 millimeters of increased posterior tibial translation to 1 millimeter at an average of 2.5 years. So we're making them stable now. And then this is my most recent study, and I feel really good about this because we had 100 consecutive patients, none dropped out. So it was over a 4 year time frame, and we started range of motion. So all these principles that we're supposed to do, early range of motion, starting, we operated early rather than later. And we found out that we're restoring a stability much better. And also when we looked at the same time frame of my isolated ACLs versus my isolated PCLs, there was no difference in outcomes. So we can do better. We can make PCL outcomes equal to our ACL outcomes if we follow these principles of double bundles, bracing them, and starting range of motion. And our stress x-rays, once again, show that they aren't stretching out. They're 1.6 millimeters at the 3 year time frame. We also did a sidebar study where when I first started out, Dr. Houston was still alive when we did our posterolateral corner reconstruction. He was very upset and called me and told me that all my posterolateral corners were going to stretch out because I wasn't casting them and I was going to learn. I've had that in the back of my brain now for 25 years. And it was kind of scary when Dr. Houston calls you and yells at you. But what we found out is that we looked at partial early weight bearing because I was too scared to do a full weight bearing. Versus non-weight bearing of our FCLs, because I felt our FCLs were just so good in terms of their function that we did this and we found out there was no difference in the side-to-side difference. So now we're looking at a prospective study with full weight bearing for FCLs. And it just helps to validate that the early motion is fine. And maybe we are being a little bit too conservative now that we have anatomic reconstructions in terms of holding back on moving these patients. So what about the outcomes of multi-ligaments? And this is kind of the culmination project, I felt, of all the stuff that we've done through the years. And these are basically single stage surgeries. We follow the same rehabilitation principles starting on day one, anatomic based reconstructions. And I had 276 patients over that 6 year time frame. So a lot more patients than were based on the systematic reviews that were out there. And we had 194 patients that had 3 years of follow up. This kid got back to being a national champ with what he does. So I think it's a lot different than what I started with in the 90s, where that kid was doomed to maybe being able to have a desk job for the rest of his life. So we've made some significant improvements. He had a PCL, ACL, posterolateral corner, partial nerve injury, and the biceps was of all stuff with a medial meniscus root tear. And he's done quite well functionally. And if you look at our 194 patients, our IKDC scores are 90, which is what most ACLs end up at. So with following these plans, we can do better. We also wanted to look at our stress x-rays because the objective information doesn't tell us the whole story when we have 3.5 years of follow-up. We really want to have longer follow-up. So we looked at the stress x-rays, which really don't change. Once you get to 6 months, hardly any of the stress x-rays in our series change up until 3 years. So the 6 month time frame is what you really want to be focusing on when you get these stress x-rays. The MCLs weren't stretching out. The posterolateral corners are kind of ending up back to normal for the other side. And the PCLs are doing quite well. We still have some cases of arthrofibrosis, so we can do better even with this program. But still, I think that we're showing that these patients are equal to ACLs and also that they're not stretching out. So there was the other interesting thing, there was no difference between the acutes and chronics, which tells me that maybe when they come in a little bit stiff, maybe we send them to rehabilitation for a while. If we do anatomic-based reconstructions, there's less risk with them having a decreased function by operating a little later and maybe send them to PT and get their motion better. And we didn't see any difference between the ACL-based and the PCL-based reconstruction. So the PCLs, when you follow these basic principles, they're doing quite well. So in conclusion, in general, surgery is better than non-operative treatment. I think we've all validated that. Single stage is better than multi-stage when it's possible. Early is better than late surgery, although with anatomic-based reconstructions, that's less of a point than it used to be. Early range of motion is better than delayed range of motion. Bracing is important to get these patients back to these functional things early on, and then you can wean them out of the brace after 1 year. And I think we're improving outcomes, especially for these sports multi-ligament injuries. So the bar has been reset, but I still think we can do better. We still can do better with these cases, arthrofibrosis and patient selection, so we can make sure we have no cases of stiffness going forward.
Thank you so much, Dr. Lepra. That was an absolutely fascinating talk, and to be able to summarize your career and contributions to multi-ligament knees in that amount of time, a tremendous amount of information, and really just impressive in how it's evolved. And to that point, a question that I had was, if a new surgeon approaches you and with all of the interest in anatomy as you touched on with the ACL, obviously one of the spinoff topics has been the ALL, how would you frame in your experience now the relevance of that structure to how we should maybe be thinking about its implications in surgery? Is it something that...
I think it's important to, if you're trying to decide if you're going to do an LET procedure or an ALL reconstruction, to go look at the literature. Historically, there was a feeling that we shouldn't do them because when they were done with the old ACLs that probably weren't anatomic position, it was overconstraining the knee and it was leading to lateral compartment arthritis. And some of the arguments are, well, a lot of those patients had meniscal resections rather than repairs, and maybe that's what was causing the arthritis. So we've done a lot of anatomy studies. So we've done it for the iliotibial band and Kaplan's fibers and everything else, and also for the ALL. And in our robotic studies, there wasn't any difference between an iliotibial band injury versus an ALL injury, depending upon what you call the ALL, because there's still some disagreement about exactly what it is. So I think what's important is if you have a case where there's extra laxity, maybe hamstring grafts, allografts, increased slope in younger patients, then you have a higher risk of having your ACL fail. And the biomechanical studies show in Alan Getgood's new stability study and the Santi group with Bertrand Sauteret-Cote also show that their failure rate is a lot less. Now, if you look at their data, it also shows that their patients take about 6 months longer to get better because adding that extra morbidity hurts your rehabilitation. And maybe they just need to change the rehab because maybe they're going a little bit too slow with it because our multi-legs aren't taking that long either. But the case in point is if you have a higher risk patient, you'll have less stress on your ACL graft if you add something laterally. It doesn't have to be an ALL. It can be the standard modified Lemaire. Take the iliotibial band strip and put it down by deep Kaplan's fibers. Those work equally as well. And that's why you have the French saying you have to do an ALL all the time, and why you have the Canadians saying you have to do an LET, because they do equally as good. So I think it's something to look at. In our case, I don't do very many, maybe two or three a year. But I think it's because if you recognize that the lateral meniscus root tears cause your ACLs to fail, and your ramp lesions cause your ACLs to fail, and putting things in an anatomic position are important, then maybe you don't have to add those. But if you're worried about those cases where you have an open physis kid with a slope of 14, their risk of failure is 80%. So it's a disaster. So maybe add a LET in that case. You can't add an ALL because of the open physis, but you can add an LET. Those are the things to kind of analyze together. And hopefully we'll figure out something as we go forward. But I don't think the literature shows that there's a difference between an LET or ALL. The studies that are out there don't show that much of a difference either. And you have to look at what they're analyzing also. They're also looking at hamstring grafts. And their failure rate is still 11% with adding those in. So BTBs haven't been studied yet. So hopefully more information will come out in terms of whether a patellar tendon is tight enough that you don't have to add that type of reconstruction augment.
You're using autografts. Are you ever harvesting the quad tendon, be it for MLs or for any of your other reconstructive efforts?
The quad tendon's in an interesting thing right now. It's a hot topic, and a lot of people have jumped into it without a lot of science. We've started with that. I have a PhD student that looked at the anatomy, the biomechanics, and all those things. And I think it's important to probably look at doing those in select patients. So I've used it in patients that have had failed hamstrings and BTBs, where when I get the CAT scan to check their tunnel size, the patella harvest site was small enough that I could take a piece of bone off the quad and use that as a revision. So I've done that like third time revision surgery, and they work pretty well. I've done it in a couple of Olympic athletes and one NFL player that got back. So I know they can stand the test of time, but I don't use it as my primary graft. We found out biomechanically that if you don't have the piece of bone attached, it's a lot weaker. So you should use a bone plug if you're using a quad tendon. And you also have to look at the registry data. So the Danes probably have done more quad reconstructions than anybody. And their failure rate with a quad tendon is 4 times that of patellar tendon. And it's double that of a hamstring. And they tried to go through and see if it was because of the learning curve, and it didn't seem to be. So they're still analyzing that data, but that's been published in KSSTA. And I was one of the reviewers on that. And I think it's important to look at that. I think it'll be something, but it's not going to be the replacement for the main grafts that we use currently.
Great talk. Thank you. Any role for internal bracing?
No.
Wonderful talk, by the way. In cases of multi-ligament injuries that may have been chronic with meniscal deficiency, where you're considering a meniscal transplant as well, how do you deal with that? Is that a staged procedure for you? And how do you address tunnel conversions in cases of needing to use bone plugs for your meniscal transplant or a trough?
The question is, what do you do with the deficiency of the meniscus and multi-ligament? Because, I mean, that's a real thing, because your ACLs with a severe anterior tibial translation with no meniscus probably are going to fail again. So you have to look at putting in the buffer posteriorly as opposed to your horn. If you get an explosive pivot shift and there's no lateral meniscus, they'll probably fail also. So you have to look at doing the transplants. I try to do them all as one stage. Luckily, you don't usually have a 3-ligament reconstruction you need to do with a meniscus transplant. Most of the time, at most, it'll be a 2-ligament. And when in my hands, it's usually been like a MCL or an FCL, not a complete posterior lateral. So I haven't had problems with that type of tunnel convergence. But it's a real thing. You have to look at it. I think it's something where I go to bed the night before at 8 o'clock, so I get a good night's sleep. And then I'm ready to go and have about 5 bags of tea in my hot tea. So I have plenty of caffeine on board. So I know I have to keep moving quickly to get through that, but it's something you can do.
Thank you, Dr. LaPrade. For more information on upcoming meetings from Kaiser, visit kpsymposia.com.